This episode of the MacCast is brought to you by Lynda.com. You can get a free 10-day trial of Lynda's outstanding video courses by going to lynda.com/MacCast. That's lynda.com/MacCast. MacCast, Friday, January 2nd, 2015. Hey, Mac Geeks, it's time for your MacCast, the show for Mac Geeks by Mac Geeks. I'm Adam, and this is the show where we discuss all things Macintosh. How you doing? Welcome back to the MacCast. Welcome to the 2015 edition of the MacCast, the first MacCast of 2015. As I mentioned, I think in the last show, we've been doing this for 10 years now. So here we are starting our 11th year. Anniversary of the MacCast, in case you want to note it on your calendar, is December 13th, 2004. That was the very first episode, but I'm glad to have you back here for the 10th or 11th season, I guess, at this point, right, of the MacCast. Is that right? Am I calculating that right? Regardless, we've got lots of great news and stories and things to talk to you about here. We're going to be looking forward, of course, to what Apple's going to be up to in 2015. We're hearing rumors of what they might be doing with Beats and that product line. Also more on Apple Pay. We're going to take a little bit of a look back at Apple's holiday activations for iPhones. They did quite well, which you probably won't find all that surprising. And a couple of hack things to let you know about, a little cautionary tale about using Thunderbolt devices from people you might not know. And photos in iCloud.com seems to have gone MIA. We'll talk about that. We'll also get to your feedback. We have a little update on iOS silent alarms. I'm going to talk about resorting to hardware hacks to try and keep your Macs alive, and my opinions on that. And we have a question about sending delayed email, also a little bit about iOS 8, and a new feature of the MacCast. We're going to talk about some of my favorite things at the moment. All of that and a whole lot more in this episode. But before we get into it, I do want to take a quick moment and thank one of my show sponsors, and that is Lynda.com. You know, Lynda has almost 6,000 courses now, video courses to help teach you new applications, new software, get you up to date, expand your existing skills, do all that fun stuff. And they're taught by some of the top leading industry experts in their field, and they're adding more and more courses weekly. These are high-quality videos. Something I love about Lynda.com is the great production value. You've got great audio, great video, screencasts, so you can actually see what's going on. Nothing's more frustrating than not having that, and Lynda does a great job putting these together. And they cover all sorts of skill levels, whether you're an advanced user and you want to expand your existing skill set, or you're brand new to a topic and you need to get up to speed quickly, they have solutions for you. And you know, it is a new year, so now's a perfect time to maybe gain a new skill or expand your existing knowledge. And they do have a wide range of courses to choose from. And what I like, too, is they're not all just technical. It's not just teaching you a software application. They also have courses that are more conceptual, others that are inspirational. So if you just need a little motivation to get you going here at the start of the year, they got you covered there as well. I'm self-employed, and so one thing I need help with is just running my business, and Lynda has business courses as well. I was poking around on there, and they have a great series on running a design business for freelancers. So you can get that course there. It covers everything from starting up a freelance business through getting paid and staying motivated while you run your business. They also have courses for improving your skill sets if you're in an existing industry. So something I needed to do recently was work with some green screen stuff, and I needed to learn how to do that. They have a great course on green screen techniques for video and photography, and I found that particularly helpful. So you can check all that stuff out. It's also great because they have a mobile app now for both iOS devices and Android, so you can really learn anytime, anywhere. And with their premium plans, you even get to download project files so that you can practice right along with the instructor. And access to all this great training and these videos starts as low as $25 a month, and that gives you unlimited access to the entire library. And best of all, MacCast listeners can get a free trial with access to everything simply by going to lynda.com lynda.com/Maccast. That's lynda.com/Maccast. They'll give you a full 10 days to try everything out. I really think you're going to love it. And a big thank you to lynda.com for their continued support of the Maccast. Well, our friends over at Cultimac have noticed a piece from the New York Post that claims that Beats executive and founder Jimmy Iovine is looking to score some more exclusive album deals for both Beats Music and iTunes in 2015. I guess what's going on is this all goes back to Apple having some really good success with launching an exclusive album for Beyoncé on iTunes in 2013, and they're looking to replicate that success with many more artists in the new year. Beyoncé's album, I guess, sold more than 800,000 copies in the first 3 days of availability, making it a huge success for online downloads and the online launching of an album. At the moment, though, one stumbling block appears to be some backlash from the labels, who aren't exactly keen or very happy about their artists making side deals with some of the streaming music providers like Spotify and Apple and all the others. But still, making these kind of deals is exactly why Apple acquired Iovine and Beats and Dr. Dre. They have deep industry connections that I think are very helpful for Apple to have continued success with iTunes, iTunes Radio, and now Beats Music. So far, Apple's remained pretty silent on the entire Beats acquisition. They haven't kind of tipped their hand as to what their plans are, but there have been signs that the service, while still somewhat of a small player, has been gaining some subscribers under Apple's watch. I'm sure they'd like it to happen much more quickly and to be much bigger, and doing these exclusive deals would, I think, go a nice part of the way to helping make that happen. There are also rumors that they may be working on a complete redesign, and it's possible at some point that Apple may rebrand Beats under the iTunes moniker, although I'm not sure that latter item would be a very good move. Beats already has a pretty good and well-established brand name. They're particularly popular with younger audiences in terms of their headphone products, and if they could parlay that into an expanded streaming music service, I think that would be the better way to go. Maybe Beats by Apple or something like that. Not really sure. Maybe they don't even want to muddle up the brands like that. But Beats is coming off a successful promotion with AT&T, who said that the deal they did with them outperformed their expectations. And again, they're going to want to continue that success moving forward. I took advantage of that Beats AT&T 90-day deal, and ultimately, personally, I found that I didn't use the service enough to make it worth continuing using it. But while I had it, I really did enjoy the whole Beats presentation, the kind of curated music from artists. It kind of helped me find and discover some things I probably wouldn't have found otherwise. It, you know, it's not quite as specific as I think some of the other streaming music services where you actually know the music you want to go into and find, but I typically don't. You know, I know the things that I like, but I like also discovering new things. And I find that in some of the music services, it's a bit hard to do that. It's one of the things I actually like about iTunes Radio. And I guess maybe since I'm an iTunes Match subscriber, that's another reason why I didn't stick with Beats. I'm happy to listen to iTunes Radio and sort of curate it that way. But I know that that whole experience isn't a fit for everyone. I guess my hope is at some point Apple will roll Beats and iTunes Music Match and maybe even iTunes Radio all into one sort of bundled streaming music service that's available at one set price. You know, I fully expect them to continue to keep iTunes Radio free, but maybe for paid subscribers, they can roll in some of the Beats functionality and stuff like that. Will that actually happen? Not entirely sure. I doubt it. I think Apple's going to continue, at least for the time being, to keep those things as separate brands. But at the very least, it looks like they're looking to maybe make some moves and announce some things with respect to the Beats music services and iTunes exclusive albums with artists in 2015. Another thing Apple is going to be looking to expand in big ways in 2015, I think, is their Apple Pay service. Last time we talked about the fact that we're now seeing hints that Apple is looking to expand in Europe, specifically in the UK. And also we've been hearing rumors of a China expansion. Well, this week brings word from The Telegraph that Apple wants to launch Apple Pay in the UK sometime in the first half of 2015. Last time we really didn't have a set time frame, although Visa sort of tipped their hand and made it sound like Apple really was looking for the first half of 2015. We now have other rumors kind of confirming that time frame. Apparently, one stumbling block, though, is in negotiations with the UK banks. They have some concerns over the personal and financial information that Apple would be collecting from their customers. Mainly, what they're thinking is that Apple will have enough information to kind of corner the payments market, and specifically the payments made with phone market, and then have probably more influence than they would really like over sort of their day-to-day operations. But it's looking like that might happen anyway because of the success of Apple Pay in the U.S. Apple's been getting a lot of good buzz. It's putting pressure or creating pressure from consumers who don't have access to Apple Pay yet and really want it. You've got those millions and millions of iPhones out there that now can take advantage of the Apple Pay service, and customers are starting to demand it. So that could put some pressure on the banks to make sure that they're part of the Apple Pay system. Otherwise, they could lose some customers, at least the ones that are Apple fans. And Apple Pay does use standard NFC technology, so it shouldn't be that difficult for the system to be rolled out in these countries. A lot of places internationally already have terminals that are capable of working with the service, so it's really just the deals getting done with the credit cards and the banks. And because the system is U.S.-based only right now, we have heard that U.S. customers can use their cards overseas in Europe and in other countries with Apple Pay terminals that use the NFC technology, and it works just fine. So rollout shouldn't be a problem. It's really just getting these deals done, and it sounds like they're getting closer and closer, at least in the U.K. Another unrelated story, but something that is also happening in EU countries, is it now looks like there's a significant change to refunds on iTunes purchases. They are now refundable for up to 14 days in many countries. Apple recently introduced a new 14-day, no questions asked return policy for iTunes, App Store, and iBook purchases in Europe. The only thing it seems like you can't get refunds on, and this would make sense, is iTunes gift cards. They are still not refundable. The policy is a no questions asked, and you can request a cancellation via the report a problem feature in your iTunes order history or via a written statement. When I was reading about this, they didn't give details about that written statement. I assume it's something that you can send via an email to the iTunes store support. Of course, I wouldn't assume that Apple is making this change purely out of the goodness of their heart, and I really don't expect the policy to carry over into other countries like the U.S. What's going on here is Apple has to comply with a new consumer rights directive in the EU that requires a 14 calendar day right of cancellation or return period on both goods and services purchased in EAA countries. The directive actually has been around since June, but it appears now that Apple is just getting around to updating their terms and conditions documents online and adding the ability to actually do the refunds within the iTunes store in the past couple weeks. It's a good thing, though, because the directive says that if a business fails to properly inform consumers about the return period, the 14-day period is then extended to a full year. So I'm sure Apple didn't want to have to be refunding iTunes app purchases, 364 days after they were actually made. And back in the U.S. with Apple Pay, it looks like Apple and Chevron are looking to expand their functionality and partnership, this time taking it all the way to the pump. Currently, Chevron allows customers to use Apple Pay inside its stores and at Texaco Extra Mile locations, but soon you will be able to use it to purchase gas. A tweet on their official Twitter account indicated that they were working directly with Apple to help enable the feature. Chevron is currently the only gas and oil company listed among Apple's official Apple Pay partners, though again, I would expect they're working hard to actually expand that. As far as when you'll be able to pay for your gas via Apple Pay right at the pump, they hope to have the systems in place by early 2015. If you received a shiny new Apple device over the holidays, it looks like you are not alone. You're actually in the majority. According to Flurry Analytics, Apple accounted for just over half of new mobile device activations over the holidays. They came in with 51.3% of the worldwide activations, according to the Flurry numbers. They get their data by tracking about 600,000 apps, and their latest numbers looked at activations from December 19th through December 25th. Running right behind Apple, Samsung and Nokia came in second and third with 18% and 6% of global activations, respectively. Now, obviously, this report is looking at a pretty small time frame, so you can't draw too much from the data, though it does seem to indicate that Apple's new iPhone 6 and 6 Plus were popular holiday gifts. Now, I'm thinking that when Apple decided to start launching new iOS devices in the fall, this was really part of their plan that, you know, holiday sales, holiday times are a big time for consumers to be spending money. And why not try and capture that revenue by releasing our new devices right before the holiday season? Obviously, it seems like it's working for them. Something that people have also been keeping a watch on that the Flurry Analytics looked into is what size devices are people preferring. And many thought that Apple was going to have huge success with the much larger iPhone 6 Plus, what I like to call a gigantophone, what others call a phablet. Well, actually, in the Flurry numbers, they looked at phablets versus what they're calling medium-sized phones, phones more like the iPhone 6 Plus, in that I'm assuming under 5-inch range. They didn't actually give specific sizes. But when they looked at their numbers, they found that phablets accounted for just 13% of new device activations, with the majority of activations happening in that medium phone range, accounting for 64% of all activations. The numbers do seem to jive with what we've been hearing from Apple sources about sales of the iPhone 6 versus 6 Plus. You remember early on, it seemed like the iPhone 6 Plus was the most popular device, but very quickly we saw that change, and pretty soon the iPhone 6 was accounting for about 2/3 of all iPhone 6, 6 Plus sales. They also did include in the Flurry numbers other devices, so they looked at all device activations, not just smartphones, but tablets as well, and they separated tablets into small and full-size tablets, each of those capturing about 11% of new device activations. So 50% large tablets, 50% smaller tablets like the iPad mini. Now, the report did talk about the trend of consumers leaning toward larger screen phones, and they did say that the iPhone 6 Plus was one of the top five devices they saw activated for Christmas, but the iPhone 6 was number one. We've been hearing, though, that there are consumers who still kind of feel that the iPhone 6 is still too big and really are happy with the current form factors of the iPhone 5C and 5S. Well, we're starting to get more rumors, and I think we talked last time about this a little bit, that Apple might bring back a 4-inch model, something they're now calling, or some people are calling at least, the iPhone 6S mini. It's basically going to be an iPhone 6 update for the iPhone 5C, 5S, essentially replacing those two models that Apple has in the lineup right now. So we expect it to be in that lower kind of starting entry-level price range. We don't have a lot more details than that, other than the fact that it sounds like Apple's at least considering keeping that kind of device around, and I think it would make sense. It'd be nice to have that sort of three device size in the Apple lineup and let the consumers choose which device is actually going to work best for them. Myself, personally, I think I've talked about the fact that I have the iPhone 6 Plus. I'm living it with it until my next upgrade. But day-to-day, it's still feeling like it's a little bit too much device for me. It's a little bit too large. I do like some of the features on the larger screen, but I'm thinking that the iPhone 6 size is going to be the right fit for me. I'm not sure I can drop all the way back down to a 4-inch phone. My wife still has my old iPhone 5S, and every time I pick that up, it starts to feel like this teeny tiny toy to me. So I've definitely already transitioned to a slightly larger screen device, I think just not as large as the 6 Plus. And I think you know, existing customers like myself transitioning to a much larger screen device, it doesn't create the best customer experience. I knew it was something I was going to go through, but maybe less tech-savvy customers, for them, it just translated into a poorer iPhone experience. And that seems to be partially reflected, at least in some numbers that we heard on customer satisfaction. This is actually one of Tim Cook's favorite quarterly results call figures. And unfortunately, it looks like Apple slipped a bit in the latest reports. The latest smartphone numbers from the American Consumer Satisfaction Index indicated that Apple was down compared to last year. Apple dropped 2.5%, moving from a score of 81 down to 79. Now, that's bad in and of itself, but it gets even worse for Apple and Tim because Samsung saw a 6.6% increase in their customer satisfaction numbers, bringing their score up to 81 and beating out Apple for the number one spot. So I don't expect Apple, or I don't expect Tim Cook to focus on customer sat at the next quarterly conference call. Now, it is not really clear why we saw a drop in Apple's numbers, but as I mentioned, we can speculate a little bit. My thought is it's a combination of a large number of new customers coming to the iPhone 6 and 6 Plus and also upgraders adjusting to the new form factor and feeling maybe a little bit awkward with it. Also, some blame can be placed on Apple, I think, because they did have some pretty bad launch issues with iOS 8, and specifically, if you remember, the iOS 8.0.1 update that bricked a number of phones, not allowing them to have phone service, which, you know, call me crazy, but that's kind of a key feature if you're going to have an iPhone, right? So not the best way to endear yourself to customers. And it also feels to me that earlier in the year, Apple was tightening policies at their Genius Bar. I don't know if you had gone in for a Genius Bar appointment, but I had a few here and there. And earlier in the year, it seemed like they weren't being as, you know, you still polite, still great customer service, but you know, there weren't as many, hey, we're going to just replace that phone for you, or we're going to take care of you. There was a lot more pushback. And I think a lot of that came from corporate kind of tying the hands of the frontline employees at the Genius Bar. It might just be my perception that that was going on, but things seem to have gotten better later in the year. I just had my experience, as you know, with my MacBook Pro. And that whole experience was absolutely great. So I think Apple's moving back again to being more customer focused. I don't know if a lot of that is because of them bringing on Angela Arendt, but I have a feeling that some of it just might be that they're moving away from sort of that bottom line and making sure that the customer experience and customer satisfaction is still number one at Apple. And I think that's ultimately a good thing. There's a new way of hacking your Mac, and not hacking your Mac in a good way. This is the bad form of hacking that surfaced this week. And I'm only covering it, I think, because not because I think it's particularly a risk that you need to be afraid of, but more something that you need to know about and something that I think is interesting. It's a way of hacking the Mac via a Thunderbolt port, and it was recently discovered and demonstrated at the Chaos Computer Congress in Hamburg, Germany. What happens is they put the attack code on the ROM of a hacked Thunderbolt device, and then when you connect that device to a Mac, it's delivered and deployed. And at that point, basically what it does is rewrite the Mac's firmware, replacing Apple's RSA key with the one of the hackers, basically meaning that they now own the system. And since the boot ROM is independent of the operating system, just reinstalling OS X will actually not remove the hack. So you basically have to go in and get your entire boot ROM rewritten in order to bypass it. Even scarier, once it's in place, it can actually replicate itself by copying itself to the option ROM on another Thunderbolt device that gets connected to the Mac, the infected Mac, and is left on during a restart. Now, I don't think this is a very big threat for a number of reasons. One, the attack does require physical access to the device, but it could be that a user unwittingly gets exploited by borrowing a malicious or compromised Thunderbolt cable or device and then connecting it into their Mac. At this point, it doesn't look like it actually exists in the wild, which is another reason why we don't have to be too concerned about it. And Apple has already implemented an intended fix for the latest Mac Mini as well as the iMac with Retina display. And it was reported that they should have updates available for other Macs as well. Still, in the meantime, I think the best way to protect yourself would be to avoid borrowing any Thunderbolt devices and making sure that you're getting your devices and accessories from reputable sources and companies. The competition for production of Apple's next-gen A-series processor, the A9, seems to be far from over, although last time we had been getting reports that Samsung was likely to win the bulk of the production contract. This week, we're hearing the rumors have changed a bit, at least if you listen to the Taipei Times. They believe that Taiwan semiconductor manufacturing company TSMC is now going to get the bulk of the orders over Samsung, and they're saying the main reason is production yield. The chip is reportedly going to use an even smaller process, and the rumors have been indicating it would vary dependent upon which company earned the contract. If Apple goes with TSMC, it's sounding like it's going to be a 16 nanometer chip, versus if they use Samsung, it would be a even smaller 14 nanometer process. The A8, by comparison right now, uses a 20 nanometer process, and it's pretty well understood that TSMC has about 60%, maybe more, of the current A8 production. The reason these chips keep moving to smaller and smaller processes is that it produces a more efficient and cooler chip, something that is more energy efficient. But the flip side of that coin is that it does make manufacturing more difficult. So it's more difficult to get those high production yields. And as we know, Apple needs a lot of chips. So I think really the reality is that Apple's going to continue to do what they always have. They're likely to use both companies. The question right now is who's going to get the bulk of the orders. And I think that's going to come down to a lot of factors. Production yield probably being the biggest part of it, because whoever can produce the largest volume can offer up the best price for Apple. And obviously, you know, price and Apple's margins are a big concern for them. But they want to make sure that they have enough chips to have supply. And I think they really don't like having all their manufacturing in one boat, at least if history is anything to indicate that. So I think they're at that nice balance right now where it's like a 60-40 split. I don't see them really wanting to adjust that too much. I don't think they'd want to flip and give, you know, 80%, 90% of production to one company. So it's still kind of too early to tell. I think we're at the point now where these manufacturers are doing test runs for Apple, and Apple's looking at the yields, looking at the quality, and ultimately, you know, they're going to pick whatever is best for Apple. But just this week, we kind of heard that, hey, things might be shifting in the other direction, back in TSMC's favor. And then I have one last small item for you in the news for this week. This happened just this morning. It appears that Apple has removed the Photos application from iCloud.com, but it's unclear why. The app was actually added back in, I want to say November, or at least November was when Apple enabled the iCloud Photo Library beta feature that was launched alongside iOS 8.1. And that is the ability to have all of your iPhoto library up in iCloud. The only thing is that as far as integration on the desktop goes, we're still waiting on Apple to release the Photos application for OS X Yosemite. That's how you're going to hook into and integrate with iCloud Photo Library. So when Apple added the Photos application to iCloud.com, it became the only way that you could actually add photos into the iCloud Photo Library. Well, that app was removed from iCloud.com and also removed from the iCloud beta website, which is the one that developers have access to. The new Photos app for Mac is supposed to launch sometime in early 2015, but again, Apple hasn't given us a hard date. So I don't know. You know, when I first heard this, I thought, well, maybe this is a sign that we're going to get the Photos app pretty soon in OS X Yosemite. Obviously, Apple hasn't said that, and we haven't seen anything yet, at least as far as at the point I've recorded this podcast. You may be hearing it later. So if they've launched the Photos app by then, I apologize. But as of right now, we're not seeing a Photos app. Apple's pulled the Photos app from iCloud.com, and there's no sign whether or not they're actually going to bring it back. And if you've used the iCloud.com Photos app to add photos to your iCloud photo library, I'm not sure how you can gain access to them now because, you know, they're not available through the web interface, and Apple has not released that final version of the photo app. So who knows if the photos will still be there, if they're going to be in your iCloud.com account, if Apple's totally deleted the data. We don't really know what's going on. But as soon as we have more information, I'll try and update you on a future episode. But with that, that's going to do it for the news for this week. Kicking off the feedback portion, I want to follow up on something we were talking about in the last episode of the MacCast, and that is the iOS alarms in the Clock app. We had a listener who wrote in and said, hey, I want to be able to have a silent alarm, something that will actually give me the alert but also vibrate my phone. And it turns out there's not really a built-in way to do that. There is a sort of no-sound alarm, but in that case, all you get is the pop-up dialogue when your alarm goes off. So we talked about how to create and use a silent alarm sound, basically make a ringtone that's completely silent in GarageBand and use that to set up your silent alarms. And I also asked you if you had any ideas about possible third-party apps that might be good if you need to set up a silent alarm. And Matthew responded, he says he uses an app called Alarmed by Yoctoville, and it sounds like a really great app. It has some more advanced features than the built-in clock application in terms of setting up your alarm. So you can set up repeating alerts, you can snooze alarms for different lengths of time and periods and things like that. So you should take a look at this. But one thing that it does that's helpful in our sort of silent alarm conversation is that it has sounds for your alarm. So you can set up various sounds and they'll go off. But unlike the clock application, it does honor the iPhone's silent switch settings. So if you actually have your phone in silent mode, the alarm's still going to go off, but it's simply going to buzz rather than actually play through. So that's one worth checking out. And thanks, Matthew, for sending along that recommendation. If you have a recommendation for another third-party alarm app, I'm still open to other ones. Let us know what you're using and how you're using it. If you can provide a little bit of detail as to why it's better than maybe the built-in application, that could be helpful as well. But shoot those emails along to maccast@gmail.com. Now I want to talk a little bit about hardware hacking, specifically hacking your Mac to kind of work around hardware issues or problems. And I'm bringing this up because there were a couple stories I ran across this week that talked about hacking Macs in different ways to kind of get around some hardware issues on some of the latest models. And it got me thinking, because I've done this sort of thing in the past. You know, we love our Macs, and sometimes I think that love can make us do somewhat crazy things to try and keep them alive and running. And I'll give you an example, because this first happened to me back with one of my all-time favorite Macs, a Mac I absolutely loved. I still love to this day, although, as you'll hear here in a second, I kind of killed it beyond resurrection. And that's my 14-inch iBook G4. Beautiful white iBook. Loved the thing. Even had a transparency insert behind the logo to turn it into a classic rainbow Apple logo from the white one. There's some images, I think, on my Flickr account if you want to see what that looks like. But regardless, it had the dreaded GPU issue where over time what happens is, you know, the motherboard heats up and eventually the solder joints and the solder points on the GPU that's on the motherboard start to become brittle and crack and break, and eventually the video stops working. And this was kind of a well-documented known issue. Unfortunately, it didn't happen until, you know, several years into the life of the machine, meaning that it was out of Apple care. And so when it happened to me, I started looking around for different fixes online, and I started encountering all these sort of Frankenstein-like hardware hacks, and most of them centered around heating up the GPU to kind of remelt the solder points and get them to reconnect. I saw one that essentially amounted to setting up a little mini bonfire right on top of the GPU using like a votive candle tray, you know, the little metal tray that goes around a votive candle, and setting a fire in there and putting that right on top of the GPU is pretty extreme. I think they used some sort of highly flammable, you know, like material, and it kind of shot sparks up and stuff like that. Most of the other ones mainly involved, in essence, baking the motherboard in an oven. I ultimately attempted one a little less extreme. Because of the thinness of the case and just how everything was oriented in there, one of the fixes was to actually fashion and just put a little shim on top of the GPU and sort of sandwich that underneath the palm rests, and that did work for me for a little bit. It allowed me to boot the machine, but then it quickly broke down and failed, I think, within a few hours. So I don't know if as the machine sort of heated up and the parts shifted around a little bit, it just sort of re-separated if it just wasn't enough of a shim. There was an even more extreme desk clamping technique that I did not try. Basically, you'd lose the portability of the Mac, but you can get it up and running by, you know, putting a vice clamp right over a specific area of the palm rest and sort of tightening it down nice and tight so that it would, again, put pressure on that GPU, kind of remaking the contacts. And then as long as you didn't move it, it would continue to work. But this is the kind of extreme stuff that I'm talking about. More recently, with the 2010 and 2011 MacBook Pro GPU issues, another thing that we've been talking about recently, because that's what my early 2011 MacBook Pro suffered from. Apple ultimately replaced the logic board, but some folks are, you know, resorting to the hardware, the basic motherboard cooking hack to kind of address that issue. And basically what that involves is pulling the logic board out of the MacBook Pro, stripping off the CPU and throwing the whole board in an oven, I think at around 340 degrees or something like that. Don't try this at home, by the way, because the whole reason we're having this conversation is I think this is a bit extreme and you probably shouldn't try to do these kinds of things. But throwing it in an oven at 340 degrees for about 7 minutes. And I think I read this over on iFixit.com, and people have reported success with this, that it sort of reflows the solder and the machine will continue to work for a little while longer. That's kind of the after the fact hack when you kind of have these heating issues or motherboard issues. Another way that folks will often hack machines is within cooling Macs. Basically, looking at the cooling system, looking at the temperatures, using temperature monitors like iStat Pro, things like that, things that can look at CPU and GPU temperatures, noticing that they seem unreasonably high, or if you have a Mac where the fans are kicking on more than you like, then going through and building some sort of custom cooling system, either opening up the casing or putting holes in the casing, venting, additional fans, maybe even liquid cooling, those sorts of things, and basically re-engineering the case design and the cooling design of the Mac. And currently, I guess some new Mac Pro owners are running through this because they've discovered, specifically with a piece of software called DaVinci Resolve from Blackmagic that is a color corrector, that they've been having issues with crashing and artifacting and bad stuff on export. And they think it's related to the ATI Fire Pro D700 graphics card in the case. And some users are thinking it's a cooling issue, that the cards are overheating and causing these graphic artifacts and crashing and things like that. I think more likely, and some of the other reports are saying, it's simply a driver issue, because they've noted that if you boot the Mac Pro into Windows and use the Windows drivers, it doesn't suffer from the same issues. And as a matter of fact, Blackmagic has even said that they believe it's a software issue. So hopefully something Apple can fix in software. But some users and reports that I read had resorted to actually building boxes around the Mac Pro and adding in fans in the intake and outtake areas to help better cool it. And they claim that actually resolves the issue. And also on the cooling front, related to the 2010-2011 MacBook Pro GPU issues, an iFixit employee recently posted an article or some images where he drilled holes in the bottom casing of the Mac Pro just under the fans to help aid in cooling. So we see these kind of extreme measures that people go through to keep their Macs alive and running. And oftentimes these fixes, like I said, do work for a little while, but almost always also when I'm reading these, you know, discussion threads and they go really long, they'll end up being temporary. They'll last maybe a few days, weeks, maybe even months for some people, but almost never have I seen them being permanent. And I think that's because it doesn't ultimately address the core issue, right? If you've got a bad graphics chip or bad solder joints or something on your motherboard, unless you're going to go in and resolder those by hand, it's probably not going to just fix it by reflowing the stuff that's already bad, right? You need a new logic board. That's the ultimate replacement. Or maybe you need a new GPU, graphics card, CPU, whatever the issue might be. So all of these hacks to me feel like a little bit like putting your Mac on life support. They don't really address the issues. And I have to wonder if they had the option, if our Macs would opt for a DNR, a do not resuscitate order, and say, look, if I have a problem, either just let me go or, you know, actually fix the root problem. Don't, you know, bake me in the oven and hope that I'm going to limp along for another couple months. And, you know, the one thing that I'll tell people, because sometimes people feel, well, my AppleCare is up, what do I have to lose? And I would argue back, if your AppleCare is up, it's still worth going into the Genius Bar, making a Genius Bar appointment, taking your Mac in, having them take a look at it. Sometimes it might not be the thing that you think it is, and the repair might be less expensive or easier to do than you think. And even if not, the worst case scenario, they're going to give you a price to fix it, and you can make an informed decision at that point. Is it worth spending that on this Mac? Should I just buy a new one? Or do I want to go home and try one of these more extreme hacks? Ultimately, the end of the story for my 2014 white iBook was I decided, you know what, I'm going to try heating up with a soldering iron the joints and see if I can get those to reflow. Well, I made some sort of error. I mean, that thing is really tiny. I'm not the best solderer in the world. And the point between the contacts on the chip are really tight. I think when I reflowed some of the solder, I jumpered a couple of the pins. And when I booted my iBook, and I think I covered this on another episode of the MacCast, if you heard the story already, I ultimately ended up frying the GPU. Got a nice little puff of smoke, and that was the end of the 14-inch iBook. So I guess I could finally repair it with the repair I probably should have done in the first place, which would be to get a new motherboard. Whether I'll do that or not remains to be seen, but, you know, learn from my mistake. And, you know, these hardware hacks, while they can be fun exercises and maybe learning, and maybe you can get your machine to limp along a little while longer, I think they're not ultimately the fix that you're going to want in the long run. Rick emailed me this week, and he had a question about sending email, something that actually has come up in the past. I don't know if we ever covered it on the show. I've answered a few emails about this, so I thought it was worth covering now, because Rick wants to be able to compose an email in macOS 10 Mail, but then schedule that mail for sending later. And that's something that you can't do built into the app. I've had a couple solutions for it in the past, but Rick, your email prompted me to do a little bit more digging this time around, and I ran across a mail plugin that I think might be helpful for this specific situation. Now, I haven't used the plugin myself, but I did double check, and it is reported by the developer to be OS X Yosemite compatible, so it should work on all the latest versions of Mac OS X. And the plugin is called Send Later. I'll have a link to it in the show notes at maccast.com. But several sites and places that I saw it featured recommended it. They said it was a good application. Looks like it has a very nice UI and will allow you right in OS X to compose your email and then set it up and schedule it for sending at a later time and date. So that's one that you might check out. Now, my solution for this in the past has been to recommend to folks that they just set up and use an automator action. And so I thought I'd cover how to do that as well. I don't know that it's as elegant as maybe the send later solution, but it can be done and you don't have to spend a dime. It's built right into your Mac. So the way that you do it is you open up your applications folder and launch the Automator application. And then when it pops up, what you're going to want to do is create a new Automator workflow. And in the little sort of wizard that asks you for the type of workflow that you want to set up, you want to choose calendar alarm as the document type. So click on that, and then when the Automator interface opens up, make sure that you can see the library column over in the left. That's going to have all your Automator actions sorted by the application that they integrate with. If you don't see that, in the toolbar, click on the Show Library button, and then when you see that library, make sure it's expanded open so that you can see all the different libraries that are available. And then go in under the Mail category and drag over and select the New Mail Message item into your workflow. Now, at this point, you're going to want to save your workflow. And the reason I'm telling you to save it now is I noticed when I was testing this, at least in OS X Mavericks, Automator does something weird with the calendar alarm type workflows. It will immediately trigger and add a calendar event to your calendar app. So be prepared when you do the save, it's going to launch the calendar app and it's actually going to set up, it's going to add something to your schedule for this, you know, the exact date and time that you do the save. And you don't want this sending out emails. So if we had built the whole workflow first and then I had you save it, it's going to send out the emails and that defeats the whole purpose, right? Because you want to be able to schedule these to send later. So do the save now. Save your workflow. Name it something like delayed email send or something like that. And then you can delete the new calendar event that it created and then close the blank email message that it's going to open up and start generating in mail. So what it'll do when you save it is it's going to add the event and then it's going to trigger the event, which is going to cause mail to open up and start a new mail message because that's the first item in your workflow. So you can get rid of that. Don't save it. Delete it all. Then go back to Automator and fill in the information for your email because the new mail message item in the workflow will have your to and BCC fields and subject fields and email body and all that stuff. So put everything that you want to have go out in that scheduled email, set it up, and then under that, go back to the library into the mail category and pull over and add to your workflow a send outgoing message item. And then once you're done with that, you can save your workflow and you are done with the workflow for now. If you've saved the workflow to the default location, it should be in your home folder, in the library folder, in the workflows folder under applications, calendar, and then you should have your new calendar event workflow or calendar alarm workflow application saved in there. And it's important to know where that is because you're going to need that here in a second. So once you've got your workflow done, you need to schedule the email. And to do that, we're going to use the calendar application. So go ahead and open up calendar and then add a new event and set its date and start and end time for the date and time that you actually want the scheduled email to be sent. And then once you have your event created, you want to add an alert for the event. And within the alert interface, you're going to choose a custom alert. And then in the custom alert dialog box, one of the options for when the alarm goes off is to open up a file. And so then what we're logically going to do is we're going to have it open up our Automator workflow. So you're going to choose other from the file dropdown and you're going to select that workflow that you created. And just like I said earlier, it's going to be in your home folder, library folder, workflows, applications, calendar, and then you should see senddelayedemail.app or whatever you named your workflow. If you saved it to some other location, then just navigate and find where you saved it and point to that. And then last thing that you're going to want to do in your alert is alter it so that the alert happens at the right at the time of the event. So not 15 minutes before or 30 minutes before, actually at the time of the event. And that should be it. Now you've got your scheduled email all scheduled up and it should be ready to send out. So at that date and time, what will happen, as long as your Mac is powered on and awake, that's really important as well. You need to make sure that you leave your Mac on and that it's awake. So you might want to go in and adjust your energy saver settings to leave the Mac running, you know, sleep the display, but don't let the Mac go to sleep until your actual scheduled email goes out. I'm not 100% sure this is necessary, but better safe than sorry. definitely you need to leave your Mac powered on. I just don't know if you have to actually have it not asleep, but I would have it not asleep just in case. And then as long as you've done that, what'll happen is at the date and time that your scheduled email is supposed to go out, your automator action is going to run. Well, first the alarm's going to trigger, right? It's going to launch your automator application, and then the application should go through, compose, and send that email. And what's nice about this, too, is if you're using notifications, you'll get that, you know, alarm notification message dialog pop up as well, so that you'll know that your email has gone out and you can double check on it and make sure that it sent and all those sorts of things. So that's how you would do it with Automator. Last thing that I'll mention is if you need more features for sending things like bulk email newsletters, things like that, of course, there are online services like MailChimp that you can check out. But if you want to do it on the Mac, an application worth checking out is Direct Mail for Mac. And I'll have a link to it in the show notes at maccast.com. Also, if you search on the website, we did an interview with them at Macworld, and it's really great bulk emailing software for the Mac. And good news is for a small list, if you have up to 50 emails a month that you want to send, it's free. If you need to send more than that, they have a couple of different options for doing that. They have pricing that's based on the number of subscribers that you might have. You can also do pay-as-you-go, where you just get email credits per email. And if you want to use your own SMTP service, so if you don't want to use their service for actually sending out the bulk email, you have your own service that you want to use, you can just pay a one-time fee for the software. I think it's around $199 US for that. But for like a small club, you know, if you have a club or something like that with under 50 members and you're only sending 50 or less emails per month, you could send out your monthly newsletter from your Mac using the Direct Mail software. So check it out. They have great tools for setting up and composing and designing your emails, as well as managing your lists and things like that. So that's just another way you can do it. And the bulk mailing software, the Direct Mail software, of course, does let you schedule your emails. So you could use that application depending upon your needs. And I hope that helps you out, Rick. And thanks for the question. Is it just me, or does iOS 8 to you seem like it continues to be plagued by these odd and very annoying UI issues? These are issues that are not, I don't think, showstoppers, but for me, they make me want to go for the iPhone distance throwing record sometimes. Like, you just want to chuck the phone because they're so annoying. And they have kind of temporary fixes, but the issues eventually come back. This is the kind of stuff where I think my friend Jeff Gamet would tell iOS 8 to go home because it's drunk, right? It's like, go home, iOS 8. You're drunk. You're weird. You're being funky, and I don't like it. And this came about this week because Tommy emailed me, and he told me about one that, thank goodness, I'm not experiencing, because I have a couple of my own to tell you about. But it sounds like, Tommy, what you're experiencing definitely fits this category. So Tommy mentioned that in iOS 8 on the iPad, he likes to use the multitasking gestures, and that for some reason, since upgrading to iOS 8, these occasionally fail. If you don't know what the multitasking gestures are, if you go into your iPad settings under General, there is a toggle box. And again, this is only on iPads, called multitasking gestures. And what this does is this allows you to use forefinger and five finger gestures within the operating system to do different things. So you can forefinger pinch to return to the home screen. So if you're in an app, you just forefinger pinch in and it brings you back to the home screen. You can also swipe up with four fingers to access the multitasking, or swipe with four or five fingers from left to right to switch to fast switch between applications. So that can be convenient. For myself, I often have it disabled. So Tommy, I may not have noticed it because I don't really use it too much. I have it disabled because it conflicts with other apps where I have four or five finger type gestures. A lot of games and things like that take advantage of that. So I end up triggering the multitasking gestures when I don't want. So most of the time I just turn that feature off. But Tommy noted that if, you know, you are experiencing this and it's failing for you, you can get stuff working again by, one, either just activating Notification Center, so just pulling down from the top of your iOS device, bringing up Notification Center, then returning to the main screen, and then your multitasking gestures will come back. Or you can simply go into the settings, general multitasking, and toggle the feature on and off. And that seems to get things up and running again. But lo and behold, you know, over time, it's going to resurface. Thus the, you know, go home iOS 8, you're drunk reference, right? And I have two of my own that are like that, or that are annoying as well. I think I've mentioned them on separate episodes of the MacCast, but I don't remember when. So I thought I'd recover them for you now in case you've run into them. And I'll give you my fixes for each of them as well. So one that I have that's pretty common is Control Center not coming up on the lock screen on my iOS device. And this is most often comes up for me when I'm trying to access the flashlight. So it's super annoying because I'm sitting there in the dark and I'm swiping up and nothing's happening. And the way I found that I could fix this is by simply doing the slide to unlock, going to the unlock screen, you know, with the number pad, and then going back to the main lock screen. And once I've done that, it sort of jogs things loose and the Control Center will work again. So you can swipe up from the bottom and get to it. The other one that took me a long time to figure out was Spotlight Search. So specifically on my iPhone 6 Plus, I would pull down on the springboard and access Spotlight, do a search, and absolutely nothing would happen. There would be no results coming in at all. And the way I discovered I could fix this would be by doing a reset of the device. So holding down the home and sleep wake buttons at the same time until the device reboots, right? Until you see the white Apple logo. And then once it was rebooted and I got back in, Spotlight would seem to work again. And it works for a while. And then eventually it breaks again. And I don't really know why. And I have to do the whole reset all over again. And that one's particularly annoying because I use Touch ID, and every time you reset your device with Touch ID, then the first time you log in, you have to use the passcode and you can't use the Touch ID. Not super annoying, but again, you get the point, right? These are all these little things that are really, really annoying and I think aren't high on Apple's priority of fixes list because they're not something that are going to stop you dead in your tracks. It's more something you're going to be frustrated by. But I think this is the kind of thing that goes back to what we were talking about earlier in terms of the customer satisfaction numbers, right? These are the little things when someone comes up to me and says, hey, how do you like your iPhone? I'm going to say, you know what? It's really great, but this is really annoying and it needs to be fixed, right? Those are exactly those sorts of things. So I don't know. What about you? Are you having some of these experiences? Are there other ones besides these three that we've mentioned that I'm missing that are particularly bugging you? Do you want to vent and just sort of share with us if you have those, or maybe you have different fixes for the ones we mentioned here, maybe ones that are more permanent or work better? I welcome your feedback, maccast@gmail.com. And then the last thing that I have for you today, and probably for future episodes, is something new. You know, it's 2015. After 10 years, I figured, you know, maybe we need to add a new segment to the show. I know we've changed things from time to time here and there. And what we're adding here is maybe not new to all podcasts, but it's somewhat new to the MacCast. And it comes about because I don't do formal product reviews on the MacCast. You've probably noticed this. It's just not part of our show. I think there's other shows that do a much better job of it. But one thing that I do is I do use a lot of stuff, right? I use apps, I have software, I have hardware that I get from time to time, and I have stuff that I like. So I figured it'd be nice to share one or two things every week that I'm really digging. So I'm going to call this segment the thing of the moment, or things of the moment, if we're doing more than one. And I actually have two things for you today. Something that the folks at Audio Engine sent me, I think a few months back, and I've been using for a while, is their Audio Engine B1 Bluetooth music receiver. And what this is it's a little device that you can hook up to your receiver, to a set of powered speakers. I actually immediately connected it to my Audio Engine P4 speakers, their passive speakers, which that's another great pick. They sound great, by the way. And I have their N22 desktop amplifier. So I hooked this up to the desktop amplifier, and immediately now I have Bluetooth audio for my Audio Engine speakers. And what really impressed me most about this product was the reliability of the connection and the sound quality. It was also dead simple to set up because the little B1 that you connect up, the little Bluetooth thing, comes with a nice antenna on it, and you just hook it up. It's powered by USB, so you can either connect it to a port on your computer, you can plug it into a USB hub or a USB wall outlet. Your choice. In my case, I could connect it directly to the USB power on the N22 desktop, which was really convenient. So you plug that in, and then you hook up the audio connection, so you can use RCA, or they actually have a digital audio connector if you want to hook it into digital audio on a receiver or something like that. So you hook that up, or just hook it directly to a set of powered speakers, and then, you know, connect to it on Bluetooth on your Mac. And it just shows right up as one of your Bluetooth options. And once you've connected, it sends all of your audio through your speakers. And like I said, it sounds phenomenal. They actually have in the hardware a 24-bit upsampling digital audio converter. So I think that's what really, really helps put it over the top. And, you know, this is a higher-end device, so it's a little bit pricier than some of the other solutions. But, you know, what you're paying for is that audio quality and the robustness of the solution. Some of the cheaper solutions, you know, I've tried some of them. You get dropouts, you get a lot of interference. They've done a lot of engineering with the B1 to kind of protect against that. They also claim that it has a better range than a lot of other products, although I haven't specifically tested that claim. Mine's actually in a small closed space. I'm in my office, which is like a 6x6 closet, as you know, if you've been listening to the show. So it's not too far away. But I have not had, I shouldn't say I haven't had any dropouts, but I have had almost no dropouts. And like I said, I've been using it for months, playing a lot of audio. I play my iTunes radio through it as I sit here working. And again, it just sounds really, really great. So you should check it out. I think it's $199 or $189 on the Audio Engine store. And you can check it out at audioengineusa.com. And I'll have links to it in the show notes at maccast.com. So that's the first thing of the moment. The second thing of the moment is an app. It's a game, and this one's free. It's called Crossy Road by Hipster Whale. And what it is, if you are a fan of the 80s game Frogger, you're absolutely going to love this. It's an Endless Runner style game. So if you like Endless Runners, you're probably going to like this as well. And in essence, what you do is you're a little character. And it starts out as a chicken, but you can, of course, earn or buy other characters. And you're trying to get across the road and the lake and train tracks and things like that. And so you just swipe up, down, left, right, and you move your character forward, and you see how far you can get up the screen. And there is an in-app purchase element of this. Like I said, it's free, really freemium. And I'd give it a medium in terms of its annoyingness, and only because occasionally at the end of a run, it will pop up and give you a little, hey, do you want to buy this character for 99 cents? But that's really about it. You can earn coins in the game, and eventually you can use the coins to go into a little prize machine. When you get 100 coins, you can pull the lever on the prize machine, and you randomly get a character. Another little bit of annoyance there is that it will issue you the same character twice, so you might eat up 100 of the hard-earned coins and get the same character, so you got to build up another 100. That is another thing that kind of pushes you more toward the in-app purchase, because you can purchase the characters for 99 cents each, but you can play the entire thing very easily without spending a dime. You don't have to have the additional characters. You could just keep the chicken for forever and just go with whatever you earn over time. Ultimately, I did end up buying the what's called the piggy bank that lets you earn coins faster. I think that's a $3.99 or $4.99 in-app purchase. And I did that mainly because I really like the game and I want to support the developer. I would have loved it if they would have just priced the game at $5 and not had any, you know, just unlocked all the characters and not had any of the in-app purchase stuff. But as you know, I've resolved, I get the new business model that we're under the new app order, and this is how developers need to be able to make their money and promote their games and stuff like that for a number of reasons, right? But let's not go into that diatribe here, because we'll be here for forever. Just have fun. Go check out Crossy Road. Another great thing about it is it does have Game Center integration, so you can challenge your friends. You can see how far your friends have got. I am MattCast on Game Center, so if you want to compete against me and see how far I've gotten and try and beat my score, you can do that there. I'd love to see you on Game Center. So that's it, Crossy Road. and the audio engine B1 for the things of the moment. And with that, that is going to do it for this episode of the MacCast. Before I leave you, I do want to take a quick moment and thank all of my show sponsors: Smile, makers of Text Expander, PDF Pen, Disc Label. Also, check out Text Expander Touch for iOS, as well as PDF Pen for your iOS devices, along with PDF Pen Scan Plus. All great software. You can get information, details at smilesoftware.com. Gazelle is the fast and simple way to sell your used gadgets. You can find out what your used iPhone, iPad, and other Apple products are worth by going to gazelle.com. And lynda.com. Lynda.com helps you keep up to date with your software, pick up brand new skills, and explore new hobbies with their easy-to-follow video tutorials. You can get a 10-day free trial to lynda.com by going to lynda.com/MacCast. That's lynda.com/MacCast. And a big thank you to all of my sponsors for their support of the show. Bandwidth for the MacCast is provided by CacheFly. They're at cachefly.com. And all advertising on the MacCast is handled by Backbeat Media. You'll find them at backbeatmedia.com. If you have any feedback for me, a comment, a question, something you'd like to hear covered on a future episode of the MacCast, I welcome your emails, your audio comments. You can send those to MacCast@gmail.com. You can also leave a voicemail on the listener hotline. That's at 281-622-4269, 281-MAC-IAM-9. And if you'd prefer to leave voicemail on Skype, you can do that as well. My Skype address is the MacCast. If you need show notes with links to anything that I talked about on this or any other episode of the MacCast, you'll find those on the website. That's at maccast.com. And if you'd like to follow me between shows, I'm on Twitter, twitter.com/MacCast. Also, you can check out the MacCast Facebook page over at facebook.com/TheMacCast. And we're also on Google Plus. Just search for MacCast on Google Plus and you'll find the community there. So I look forward to seeing you online. And until next time, I will talk to you all again real soon.